The Nebulae Coat by John Meade Faulkner. Chapter 11. The old Bishop of Carisbury was dead, and a new Bishop of Carisbury reigned in his stead. The appointment had caused some chagrin in low church circles, for Dr. Willis, the new bishop, was a high churchman of pronounced views. But he had a reputation for deep personal piety, and a very short experience sufficed to show that he was full of Christian tolerance and tactful loving-kindness. One day, as Mr. Charnall was playing a voluntary after the Sunday morning service, a chorister stole up the little winding steps and appeared in the organ loft just as his master had pulled out a handful of stops and dashed into the stretto. The organist had not heard the boy on the stairs, and gave a violent start as he suddenly caught sight of the white surplice. Hands and feet for an instant lost their place, and the music came perilously near breaking down. It was only for an instant. He pulled himself together and played the fugue to its logical conclusion. Then the boy began, "Canon Parkin's compliments," but broke off, for the organist greeted him with a sound cuff and "How many times have I told you, sir, not to come creeping up those stairs when I am in the middle of a voluntary? You startle me out of my senses, coming round the corner like a ghost."
"I'm very sorry, sir," the boy said, whimpering. "I'm sure I never meant. I never thought."
"You never do think," Mr. Charnall said. "Well, well, don't go on whining. Old heads don't grow on young shoulders. Don't do it again, and there's a sixpence for you. And now, let's hear what you have to say."
Sixpences were rare things among Collarn boys, and the gift consoled more speedily than any balm in Gilead.
"Canon Parkin's compliments to you, sir, and he would be glad to have a word with you in the clergy vestry."
"All in good time. Tell him I'll be down as soon as I've put my books away."
Mr. Charnall did not hurry. There were the psalter and the chant book to be put open on the desk for the afternoon. There were the morning service and the anthem book to be put away, and the evening service and the anthem book to be got out. The establishment had once been able to afford good music books, and in the list of subscribers to the first edition Boyce, the list which so mortified poor Dr. Boyce by its smallness, you may see to this day "The Rector and Foundation of Collarn Minster," 6 copies. Mr. Charnall loved the great Boyce, with its parchment paper and largest of large margins. He loved the crisp sound of the leaves as he turned them, and he loved the old-world clefs that he could read 9 staves at a time as easily as a short score. He looked at the weekly list to check his memory. "Awake Up My Glory, Wise." No, it was in volume 3 instead of 2. He had taken down the wrong volume, a stupid mistake for one who knew the copy so well. How the rough calf backs were crumbling away. The rusty red leather dust had come off on his coat sleeves. He really was not fit to be seen, and he took some minutes more to brush it all off. So it was that Canon Parkin chafed at being kept waiting in the clergy vestry, and greeted Mr. Charnall on his appearance with a certain tartness.
"I wish you could be a little quicker when you are sent for. I am particularly busy just now, and you have kept me waiting a 1/4 hour at least."
As this was precisely what Mr. Charnall had intended to do, he took no umbrage at the rector's remarks, but merely said,
"Pardon me. Scarcely so long as 1/4 hour, I think. Well, do not let us waste words. What I wanted to tell you was that it has been arranged for the Lord Bishop of Carisbury to hold a confirmation in the Minster on the 18th of next month at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We must have a full musical service, and I shall be glad if you will submit a sketch of what you propose for my approval. There is one point to which I must call your attention particularly. As his lordship walks up the nave, we must have a becoming march on the organ.
not any of this old-fashioned stuff of which I have had so often to complain, but something really dignified and with a tune to it.
Oh, yes, we can easily arrange that, Mr. Charnel said obsequiously. See the conquering hero comes by Handel would be very appropriate. Or there is an air out of one of Offenbach's operas that I think I could adapt to the purpose. It is a very sweet thing if rendered with proper feeling. Or I could play a danse macabre slowly on the full organ.
Ah, that is from the Judas Maccabeus, I conclude, said the rector, a little mollified at this unexpected acquiescence in his views. Well, I see that you understand my wishes, so I hope I may leave that matter in your hands. By the way, he said, turning back as he left the vestry, what was the piece which you played after the service just now?
Oh, only a fugal movement, just a fugue of Kimberger's.
I wish you would not give us so much of this fugal style. No doubt it is all very fine from a scholastic point of view, but to most it seems merely confused. So far from assisting me in the choir to go out with dignity, it really fetters our movements. We want something with pathos and dignity, such as befits the end of a solemn service, yet with a marked rhythm, so that it may time our footsteps as we leave the choir. Forgive these suggestions. The practical utility of the organ isn't so much overlooked in these days. When Mr. Newt is taking the service, it does not so much matter. But when I am here myself, I beg that there may be no more fugue.
The visit of the Bishop of Carisbury to Collarn was an important matter, and necessitated some forethought and arrangement.
"The bishop must, of course, lunch with us," Mrs. Parkin said to her husband. "You will ask him, of course, to lunch, my dear."
"Oh, yes, certainly," replied the canon. "I wrote yesterday to ask him to lunch."
He assumed an unconcerned air, but with only indifferent success, for his heart misgave him that he had been guilty of an unpardonable breach of etiquette by writing on so important a subject without reference to his wife.
"Really, my dear," she rejoined, "really, I hope at least that your note was couched in proper terms."
"Pshaw," he said, a little nettled in his turn, "do you suppose that I have never written to a bishop before?"
"That is not the point. Any invitation of this kind should always be given by me. The bishop, if he has any breeding, will be very much astonished to receive an invitation to lunch that is not given by the lady of the house. This, at least, is the usage that prevails among persons of breeding."
There was just enough emphasis in the repetition of the last formidable word to have afforded a casus belli, if the rector had been minded for the fray, but he was a man of peace.
"You are quite right, my dear," was the soft answer. "It was a slip of mine, which we must hope the bishop will overlook. I wrote in a hurry yesterday afternoon, as soon as I received the official information of his coming. You were out calling, if you recollect, and I had to catch the post. One never knows what tuft-hunting may not lead people to do. And if I had not caught the post, some pushing person or other might quite possibly have asked him sooner. I meant, of course, to have reported the matter to you, but it slipped my memory."
"Really," she said with fine deprecation, being only half pacified, "I do not see who there could be to ask the bishop except ourselves. Where should the Bishop of Carisbury lunch in Collarn except at the rectory?" In this unanswerable conundrum, she quenched the smoldering embers of her wrath.
I have no doubt, dear, that you did it all for the best, and I hate these vulgar, pushing nobodies who try to get hold of everyone of the least position quite as much as you can hate them. So let us consider whom we ought to ask to meet him. A small party, I think it should be. He would take it as a greater compliment if the party were small. She had that shallow and ungenerous mind which shrinks instinctively from admitting any beauty or intellect in others, and which grudges any participation in benefits, however amply sufficient they may be for all. Thus few must be asked to meet the bishop, that it might the better appease that few indeed, besides the rector and Mrs. Parkin, were fit to associate with so distinguished a man.
"I quite agree with you," said the rector, considerably relieved to find that his own temerity in asking the bishop might now be considered as condoned. "Our party must above all things be select. Indeed, I do not know how we could make it anything but very small. There are so few people whom we could ask to meet the bishop."
"Let me see," his wife said, making a show of reckoning collar and respectability with the fingers of one hand on the fingers of another. "There is..." She broke off as a sudden idea seized her. "Why, of course, we must ask Lord Plantamer. He has shown such marked interest in ecclesiastical matters that he is sure to wish to meet the bishop."
"A most fortunate suggestion, admirable in every way. It may strengthen his interest in the church, and it must certainly be beneficial to him to associate with correct society after his wandering and bohemian life. I hear all kinds of strange tales of his hobnobbing with this Mr. Westray, the clerk of the works, and with other persons entirely out of his own rank. Mrs. Flint, who happened to be visiting a poor woman in a back lane, assures me that she has every reason to believe that he spent an hour or more in the clerk's house, and even ate there. They say he positively ate tripe."
"Well, it will certainly do him good to meet the bishop," the lady said. "That would make four with ourselves, and we can ask Mrs. Bulteel. We need not ask her husband. He is painfully rough, and the bishop might not like to meet a brewer. It will not be at all strange to ask her alone. There is always the excuse of not liking to take a business man away from his work in the middle of the day."
"That would be five. We ought to make it up to six. I suppose it would not do to ask this architect fellow or Mr. Charnall."
"My dear, what can you be thinking of? On no account whatever. Such guests would be most inappropriate." The rector looked so properly humble and cast down at this reproof that his wife relented a little. "Not that there is any harm in asking them, but they would be so very ill at ease themselves, I fear, in such surroundings. If you think the number should be even, perhaps we might ask old Newt. He is a gentleman, and would pass as your chaplain and say grace." Thus the party was made up, and Lord Blandimer accepted, and Mrs. Bulteel accepted, and there was no need to trouble about the curate's acceptance. He was merely ordered to come to lunch. But after all had gone so well up to this point, the unexpected happened. The bishop could not come. He regretted that he could not accept the hospitality so kindly offered him by Canon Parkin. He had an engagement which would occupy him for any spare time that he would have in Collern. He had made other arrangements for lunch. He would call at the rectory half an hour before the service. The rector and his wife sat in the study, a dark room on the north side of the rectory house, made sinister from without by dank laurestinus, and from within by glass cases of badly stuffed birds. A Bradshaw lay on the table before them.
"He cannot be driving from Carisbury," Mrs. Parkin said. Dr. Willis does not keep at all the same sort of stables that his predecessor kept. Mrs. Flint, when she was attending the annual Christian Endeavor meeting at Carisbury, was told that Dr. Willis thinks it wrong that a bishop should do more in the way of keeping carriages than is absolutely necessary for church purposes. She said she had passed the bishop's carriage herself, and that the coachman was a most unkempt creature, and the horses two wretched screws.
"I heard much the same thing," assented the rector. "They say he would not have his own coat of arms painted on the carriage, for what was there already was quite good enough for him. He cannot possibly be driving here from Carisbury. It is a good 20 miles.
Well, if he does not drive, he must come by the 12:15 train. That would give him 2 hours and a quarter before the service. What business can he have in Cullern? Where can he be lunching? What can he be doing with himself for 2 mortal hours and a quarter?
Here was another conundrum, to which probably only one person in Cullern town could have supplied an answer, and that was Mr. Charnall. A letter had come for the organist that very day. The Palace, Carisbury. My dear Charnall, I had almost written, my dear Nick, 40 years had made my pen a little stiff, but you must give me your official permission to write my dear Nick the very next time. You may have forgotten my hand, but you will not have forgotten me. Do you know, it is I, Willis, who am your new bishop? It is only a fortnight since I learnt you were so near me. Quam dulce amicitias, retintegrare nicidas. And the very first point of it is that I am going to sponge on you and ask myself to lunch. I am coming to Cullern at 12:45 today, fortnight, for the confirmation, and have to be at the rectory at 2:30. But till then, an old friend, Nicholas Charnall, will give me food and shelter, will he not? Make no excuses, for I shall not accept them, but send me word to say that in this you will not fail of your duty, and believe me always to be yours, John Carum. There was something that moved strangely inside Mr. Charnall's battered body as he read the letter. An upheaval of emotion, the child's heart within the man's, his young hopeful self calling to his old hopeless self. He sat back in his armchair and shut his eyes, and the organ loft in a little college chapel came back to him, and long, long practicings, and Willis content to stand by and listen as long as he should play. How it pleased Willis to stand by and pull the stops and fancy he knew something of music. No, Willis never knew any music, and yet he had a good taste and loved a fugue. There came to him country rambles and country churches, and Willis with an ABC of Gothic architecture trying to tell an early English from a decorated molding. There came to him illimitably long summer evenings, with the sky clearest yellow in the north, hours after sunset. Dusty white roads with broad galloping paths at the side, drenched with heavy dew. The dark, mysterious boskage of Stowe Wood, the scent of the syringa in the lane at Beckley, the white mist sheeting the Cherwell Vale, and supper when they got home, for memory is so powerful an alchemist as to transmute suppers as well as sunsets. What suppers! Cider cup with borage floating in it, cold lamb and mint sauce, watercress, and a triangular commons of Stilton. Why, he had not tasted Stilton for 40 years. No, Willis never knew any music, but he loved a fugue. Ah, the fugues Willis had listened to. And then a voice crossed Mr. Charnall's memory, saying, "When I am here myself, I beg that there may be no more fugue." No more fugue. There was a finality in the phrase, uncompromising as the no more sea of the apocalyptic vision. It made Mr. Charnall smiled bitterly. He woke from his daydream and was back in the present. Oh, yes, he knew very well that it was his old friend whom he, when he first saw on whom the choice had fallen for the bishopric. He was glad Willis was coming to see him. Willis knew all about the row, and how it was that Charnall had to leave Oxford. Eh, but the bishop was too generous and broad-minded to remember that now. Willis must know very well that he was only a poor out-at-elbows old fellow, and yet he was coming to lunch with him. But did Willis know that he still... He did not follow the thought farther, but glanced in a mirror, adjusted his tie, fastened the top button of his coat, and with uncertain hands brushed the hair back on either side of his head. No, Willis did not know that. He never should know. It was never too late to mend. He went to the cupboard and took out a bottle and a tumbler. Only very little spirit was left, and he poured it all into the glass. There was a moment's hesitation, a moment while enfeebled willpower was nerving itself for the effort. He was apparently engaged in making sure that not one minim of the most costly liquor was wasted. He held the bottle carefully inverted and watched the very last and smallest drop detach itself and fall into the glass. No, his willpower was not altogether paralyzed. Not yet. And he dashed the contents of the glass into the fire. There was a great blaze of light blue flame, and a puff in the air that made the window panes rattle. But the heroic deed was done, and he heard a mental blast of trumpets and the acclaiming voice of the victor sui. Willis should never know that he still... because he never would again. He rang the bell, and when Miss Euphemia answered it, she found him walking briskly, almost tripping, to and fro in the room. He stopped as she entered, drew his heels together, and made her a most profound bow.
"Hail, most fair Chastelaine! Bid the varlets lower the drawbridge and raise the portcullis. Order pasties and sousefish and a butt of Malmsey. See the great hall is properly decored for my lord Bishop of Carisbury, who will take his ambigue and bait his steeds at this castle." Miss Joliffe stared. She saw a bottle and an empty tumbler on the table and smelt a strong smell of whiskey, and the mirth faded from Mr. Charnall's face as he read her thoughts.
"No, wrong," he said. "Wrong this once. I am sober as a judge, but excited. A bishop is coming to lunch with me. You are excited when Lord Blandimer takes tea with you, a mere trashy temporal peer. Am I not to be excited when a real spiritual lord pays me a visit? Hear, O woman, the Bishop of Carisbury has written to ask, not me to lunch with him, but him to lunch with me. You will have a bishop lunching at Bellevue Lodge."
"Oh, Mr. Charnall, pray, sir, speak plainly. I am so old and stupid, I can never tell whether you are joking or in earnest."
So he put off his exaltation and told her the actual facts.
"I am sure I don't know, sir, what you will give him for lunch," Miss Joliffe said. She was always careful to put in a proper number of sirs,
for though she was proud of her descent, and considered that so far as birth went, she need not fear comparison with other collarn dames, she thought it a Christian duty to accept fully the position of landlady to which circumstances had led her.
"I am sure I don't know what you will give him for lunch. It is always so difficult to arrange meals for the clergy. If one provides too much of the good things of this world, it seems as if one was not considering sufficiently their sacred calling. It seems like Martha, too cumbered with much serving, too careful and troubled to gain all the spiritual advantage that must come from clergymen's society. But, of course, even the most spiritually minded must nourish their bodies, or they would not be able to do so much good. But when less provision has been made, I have sometimes seen clergymen eat it all up,
and become quite wearied, poor things, for want of food. It was so, I remember, when Mrs. Sharp invited the parishioners to meet the deputation after the church missionary meeting. All the patties were eaten before the deputation came, and he was so tired, poor man, with his long speech, that when he found there was nothing to eat, he got quite annoyed. It was only for a moment, of course, but I heard him say to someone, whose name I forget, that he had much better have trusted to a ham sandwich in the station refreshment room. And if it is difficult with the food, it is worse still with what they are to drink. Some clergymen do so dislike wine, and others feel they need it before the exertion of speaking. Only last year, when Mrs. Bulteel gave a drawing-room meeting, and champagne with biscuits was served before it, Dr. Stymie said quite openly that though he did not consider all who drank to be reprobate, yet he must regard alcohol as the mark of the beast, and that people did not come to drawing-room meetings to drink themselves sleepy before the speaking. With bishops it must be much worse, so I don't know what we shall give him.
"Don't distress yourself too much," the organist said, having at last spied a gap in the serried ranks of words. "I have found out what bishops eat. It is all in a little book. We must give him cold lamb, cold ribs of lamb, and mint sauce, boiled potatoes, and after that, Stilton cheese."
"Stilton?" Miss Joliffe asked with some trepidation. "I am afraid it will be very expensive." As a drowning man in one moment passes in review the events of a lifetime, so her mind took an instantaneous conspectus of all cheeses that had ever stood in the cheese cradle in the palmy days of Widcombe, when hams and plum puddings hung in bags from the rafters, when there was cream in the dairy and beer in the cellar. Blue Vinny, Little Gloucesters, Double Besants, even sometimes a cream cheese with rushes on the bottom. But Stilton, never! "I am afraid it is a very expensive cheese. I do not think anyone in Collern keeps it."
"It is a pity," Mr. Charnel said. "But we cannot help ourselves, for bishops must have Stilton for lunch. The book says so. You must ask Mr. Custance to get you a piece, and I will tell you later how it is to be cut, for there are rules about that, too."
He laughed to himself with a queer little chuckle. Cold lamb and mint sauce with a piece of Stilton afterwards. They would have an Oxford lunch. They would be young again and undefiled. End of part 1 of chapter 11.